Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. This evening it was suggested that I discuss insight, say a few words about insight. So I came up with a list of 20 essential causes for insight. This is the first time I've given this talk. Normally I give talks extemporaneously. We don't pre-plan the talks, it just flows from the particular circumstances and the people, it just flows from the heart. But this evening, I get organized. Created 20 essential causes for insight. So let's talk about insight. Insight obviously is a key feature of this meditation society. The first, number one. Now the number one, first cause of insight is to be healthy. Now the first step in Buddhist practice is the view, right? Understanding, having an accurate conceptual understanding of what insight is, the purpose of insight. There's a reason that the Noble Eightfold Path begins with right understanding or right view. Yeah. So what is insight? This ideal that we have, that we work for, that we go on meditation retreats for. So insight, as we understand it in our tradition and in the suttas, is a clear and accurate understanding of reality as it actually is, seeing things as they truly are, or at least more clear than we normally see it. Now, insights come in varying degrees. They don't, it's not like one insight fits all. There are a varieties of depth and profundity to insights. Now, often insights in the beginning might be very small, but because they're new, they seem earth-shattering. And then as we become more and more experienced, insights start to flow more often, and they may be more and more profound, but it doesn't feel as earth-shattering because that then starts to become the norm. So what's the purpose of insight? Why? Why bother to see things as they actually are? If it was possible to be happy and deluded, then there would be no reason for insight. But unfortunately, ignorance is not really bliss. And what happens is that the mental habits that we create through misunderstanding the nature of reality tend to lead to what we call in Buddhism suffering or dukkha. Now this Pali word, dukkha, I'm gonna mention a few Pali words because certain Pali words capture a range of meaning and a depth of meaning that individual English words simply do not. So by the word dukkha, this is the first noble truth, and this encapsulates everything which is short of full enlightenment or nibbana, right? From the most intense suffering that we would all recognize as horrific to more subtle forms of suffering that we deal with maybe on a regular basis in life, whether that's disappointment, frustration, loneliness, depression, guilt, anxiety. These types of mental states are dukkha. Physical uncomfortable feelings, This is all what we mean by dukkha. But then there's a whole subtle range of dukkha that exists even in the happiest of times. And because we have not experienced something more profound, then we don't recognize it as dukkha. So the idea that there's a path for eliminating dukkha in the more visible forms is often the reason why we get interested in meditation or spiritual practice of some kind. Now, eradicating dukkha completely and forever, this is what the Buddha refers to as enlightenment. Now, the English word enlightenment, again, is a bit vague. It can be used in a rather fuzzy way. You see enlightenment in European philosophy. You see enlightenment in car commercials. You see enlightenment, almost anything can say, oh, this is very enlightening. But the Pali word that comes from is called Nibbana. The Sanskrit is Nirvana. Familiar here in Seattle. So, Nibbana was a very precise term. The Buddha used this very precisely. It was not a vague term. And Nibbana refers to the complete purification of our consciousness from all causes that lead to dukkha. So these are mental habits. We tend to call them defilements because they defile the natural purity of the mind or the natural purity of consciousness. But they are very deeply established habits. The roots tend to be summarized as greed, hatred, and delusion. Now, these are extreme forms. Greed is an extreme form of the mind moving towards external sense objects, looking for happiness from without. Thinking we're going to find the happiness that we're craving from without. The movement of the mind away. And the opposite, is equally true when the mind tries to push something away. Now, the extreme form of hatred, is very obvious, but there's many more subtle forms. Just the subtle lack of contentment, not being fully content, is a subtly not pushing things away. So the movement of the mind for, and against, instead of being still. Now, even these roots, these root defilements, these have their root in delusion. So this is where insight comes in. The delusion is that lack of clear understanding. Essentially, we're all very deluded. And it's good to realize that in the beginning. And it's okay. That's where we all start. And delusion is very tricky because we don't feel like we're deluded. Sometimes it's obvious that we are, but usually it feels like, well, no, I see things clearly enough. I understand things clearly enough. We're competent doing this and, able to understand things relatively well. Other people may be deluded. I can see that, but but not me. But the normal unenlightened way that we experience reality is through a complicated web of misperceptions and projections. So we misperceive what we're experiencing, like deeply misperceive it. And then that reinforces our sense of self, who we think we are, the things that we identify with. Then that gets projected out, reinforcing our existing opinions and views of how we understand reality. And so our reality, what we call our reality, becomes this very self-created, deluded entity. And sometimes that overlaps with other people's diluted realities. And we can agree on things. Now, if this always led to being happy and content and peaceful, it wouldn't be such an issue. But unfortunately, it doesn't. Even though we may aspire to being happy, we may aspire to be peaceful, we may aspire to be whatever it is that we aspire towards. Often we find ourselves making the choices in life that lead to its opposite. So why is that? Why is it that we, you know, clearly we want something, and yet often, you know, we find ourselves in the midst of pain, sadness, frustration, or sometimes just go through periods of confusion or depression. And that's just our personal life. You say nothing of all of the difficulties we see in the world. So why is it when human beings aspire to happiness, there is so much pain and real, obvious, clear suffering in the world? If insights were easy, that would be nice. Or if even we could just convince ourselves to have insights, somehow say, well, if I just force myself hard enough, I'll have insights. But it doesn't work. So then we have to look at, well, what is actually going to work to undermine delusion? Delusion is so vague, it's so difficult for us to see because we're immersed in it. What we can do is to look at the causes for developing insights. We can look at the causes. Like Ajahn Chah used to say, you can't force a tree to grow. You can't force insight to grow. You can't, you know, you plant a tree. You can't force it to grow. You can't tug on it to make it grow faster. That just makes it worse. But what we can do is to water it. Yeah, we give it nutrition, pull the weeds, you know, protect it from animals. We can protect it, nurture it. And so once we start to understand how the causes work, then we trust that the results will follow on their own. So you can't force insight, but what you can do is to understand what causes then lead to insights, which will then gradually penetrate delusion. If we think of delusion like a fog, you know, we're lost in the fog on a mountain, and then an insight is when the fog temporarily, momentarily breaks, and we can at least see the landscape a little bit before it closes in again. And even once it's closed in, at least we have that memory, that experience that guides us. So insight, by definition, by the Buddha's definition, can only happen when the mind is free of what is called the five hindrances. Now, the five hindrances are a way that the Buddha categorized the obstacles that arise in meditation into five different categories. And only when the mind is at least temporarily free of them, do we have enough clarity to be able to see things as they actually are, to some extent. Now, these five hindrances, you may be familiar with them already. First is sensual desire. You know. Second is anger or ill will. Third is sleepiness. When we're meditating, we're just, again, this delusion-based, you know, just going into sleepiness. That lack of clarity. And then the fourth is a restlessness of mind, restlessness, worry, remorse. And the final one is doubt, this confusion about what we should be doing and how we're doing it. These five hindrances are the food for delusion. Often we trace things back to delusion as a primary cause, but even delusion has a cause. For example, in dependent origination, when we talk about, you know, the cause and effect principle, delusion or suffering has a cause, and it traced back to becoming and birth and attachment and craving and sense contact, and it's traced all the way back to delusion. But even delusion has a cause, and that's the five hindrances, because when we perceive things, when we perceive our experience through the lens of the five hindrances, then it tends to warp what we're looking at. It tends to twist our experience of reality so that it keeps perpetuating delusion. So the only way that we can gradually overcome these five hindrances is then through an entire lifestyle, which is then going to gradually lead to us being centered and clear. So when we talk about developing a way of life which is going to lead to clarity and insight, you can't talk about insight unless if you divorce it from the rest of life. You can't talk about it in terms of, well, I'm just going to do it as a practice for periods of the day, because it just doesn't. It just doesn't work if you treat it like a hobby. The five hindrances then are overcome gradually through an entire way of life, which we call the Noble Eightfold Path. Now, part of that Noble Eightfold Path, part of this way of life, is living in a way which is moral, what we call sila. Now, this is an essential prerequisite. It's impossible for insight to occur if we're not living in a wholesome way. It's very easy in life to make decisions which then lead to causes and effects in our mind which are very upsetting. Right? So the Buddha said, at least take this standard of the five precepts. Now, the five precepts are not intentionally harming, not stealing, being trustworthy in our relationships, not intentionally lying or misrepresenting the truth, and not intoxicating oneself. By a devotion to a lifestyle in this way, it leads to the peace of mind that is free from regrets. Often then, when we do things, we sit down to meditate, the things which come up to disturb the peace of mind, maybe related to things we've said, that maybe we wish we hadn't said, things we've done, any time that we harm anyone else, this will be a direct block for insight. This will be an obstacle. So there's a purification process that we gradually start to receive the results of our old karma. But if we can refrain from making any further unwholesome or called bad karma, then that will gradually allow the mind to calm down. Now, one of the other things that is very helpful for developing insight, which maybe is not stressed enough, I think, in the West is generosity. And when we talk about generosity, I'm not just talking about the dana basket. We're talking about an attitude towards life which is always looking to see how can I help someone else. And in monastic life, this is stressed a lot because we all need to keep making as much good karma as possible. This is like the fuel that powers our vehicle. So in monastic life, we're always finding ways to help others. We look after the senior monks, we wash the bowls, we clean their huts, we wash the robes. When guests come, we look after them properly. When junior ones come, we help them and teach them. When guests come to the monastery, we're always doing things for other people, right? And people do things for us, and it's a beautiful way to live. And what it does is really take the emphasis off of oneself, right? So finding ways that we can be generous and helpful and giving, then lays a very strong foundation for developing insight later on. Now, the fifth essential cause for developing insight is mindfulness. Now, these days, mindfulness, of course, is very mainstream. You find mindfulness is all different areas of life being taught. But mindfulness in and of itself, although it's very, very important, it is not the be-all and end-all of Buddhist practice. It's one very important part of the Noble Eightfold Path, and it has to be there for every part of our practice. So we learn how to be mindful through establishing awareness with our body. So every time we move, every time we move our arm, every time we get up, every time we're established in a posture, if we're sitting, then know that we're sitting. When we move, when we're walking, then clearly know that we're walking. If we're very established in our body, very grounded in our body, then it's very easy to see mental states arise. We see thoughts, moods, emotions arising, passing away. We recognize them. So instead of just being lost in thought or lost in moods and emotions, we at least recognize what's going on, both physically and mentally in our reality. So this mindfulness then has to be developed from the time we wake up in the morning all the way to the time we go to bed at night. And so meditation then is not simply a posture, a sitting posture or a walking posture, but is an attitude, a way that we approach life in every activity. As mindfulness gradually becomes stronger, then it's as if we're being able to observe more independently, observe and watch. We see this body and mind functioning within this sphere of clear awareness. But in the beginning, we have to start with whatever we can, any activity that we regularly do. Say, okay, I'm going to take this as my tool for developing mindfulness. We start with a drop here and a drop there and a drop there, and gradually it becomes a continuous flow. But in the beginning, you just have to start with wherever you can. If you sit for meditation for half an hour and you have at least a few breaths where you're clearly aware of the sensations of the air flowing in, flowing out, that's good. It's a good start. I like to encourage people to be mindful when they're brushing their teeth. You can take something that you do every day, like brushing your teeth. Hopefully you do it every day. When you're brushing your teeth, there's not a lot else that we can do at the same time. You can't really, I suppose you could be checking your phone. theoretically possible. But you could be planning your day, you could be thinking about what someone else said, but why not use that as time for meditation? It's so easy to say, oh, I'm so busy, I don't have time to meditate. Well, when you're brushing your teeth, okay, well, that's time to meditate. At least you have a minute or two. And just pay close attention to every sensation of the brush on the teeth and the gums and the cheek and, you know, the movement of the hand and the arm and the movement of the mind. We're brushing our teeth. What's our mind doing? We don't need to be thinking. Sometimes we just think too much. It's not that thought is the enemy. Thoughts are not enemy. Thoughts are natural. But often we think in a very excessive, undisciplined way. And it doesn't necessarily help. It doesn't necessarily help us live any better or more effectively. So developing a continuity of mindfulness with every activity throughout the day, right? I mean, this is a full-time practice. And this is emphasized a lot, but there's many other things as well. I've known meditators who can be very serious practitioners, but they tend to be a bit cynical or negative about life. And maybe confuse us, an intelligent, fault-finding mind, for wisdom. And it doesn't seem to work very well. So having a positive outlook on life generally is more conducive to insight. Now, we're just trying to see things as they truly are, but sometimes we can develop habits of fault-finding or habits of seeing things in a particular way. And then we see it, and we start to see it everywhere, and it keeps reinforcing what we think we already know. So trying to have a general positive outlook to life. Joy is one of the factors of enlightenment. You can't get enlightened without joy. It's fortunate. I mean, enlightenment is hard enough as it is. Imagine if the Buddha said, no, joy is a defilement. You're not allowed to feel any joy whatsoever. Suffering is not only the way, it is the end. So that would, yeah, that'd be a lot less popular. And fortunately, it's simply the natural way that the mind arises is that when we stop creating the causes of suffering, yeah, joy arises. It's like joy is there. It's waiting to bubble up any time. It's just a natural part of a mind that's peaceful, and yet we keep blocking it. We intend, you know, this is part of the delusion. We want to be happy. We want to be joyful, and yet we do things which block the natural joy from arising. So, you know, why? Why would we choose to do that? Because of delusion. So having a joyful, positive attitude towards life, you know, we can encourage that. You can't force yourself to do that, and you don't want to put too much pressure on yourself. So we want to see things realistically, but realize that, you know, the natural mind is joyful, and that's realistic. But also acknowledge the pain and suffering in our lives. Now that's very important too. Not to cover over, not to try to hide, not to try to convince ourselves that we are happy all the time out of a fear that if we admit that we're sometimes depressed or disappointed or frustrated or unhappy, that it's a failure. Or that other people may may see us as failures. Sometimes, you know, I can see someone is clearly suffering, you know, in many ways. But if I ask him how he's doing, he's like, great. Great, everything's wonderful. I'm wonderful. As if there's a fear of actually owning up. And that's okay, it's good. Of course, that's first noble truth. Sometimes it sucks. You know, sometimes we feel pain. We don't get what we want. That's disappointing. We're going to experience mental pain. We're going to experience physical pain. That is the way it is, right? And that's not necessarily having a negative view of life. We're just trying to, okay, well, let's get closer and closer to reality. Now, the natural, undefiled state of the mind is very joyful. It's bright. But when we're not there, then recognize and clearly look at the things which are not wonderfully joyful and content, because then we want to do something about it. So it takes a high degree of self-honesty. Okay, number 8 I put down is renouncing attachment to opinions. Because some people become so passionate about their opinions that it tends to cloud their view of reality. It begins to become more and more difficult to actually see things as they actually are. Yeah? Because there's so much ego identification wrapped up in a particular view or opinion, the way of seeing things. Right? So meditators sometimes can really lose the plot when they become very passionate, you know, about their particular opinions, even if it's an opinion about a meditation technique. So we have opinions. Of course we have opinions. But so what? You know, sometimes opinions are wrong. More or less correct, sometimes less correct or inaccurate. And just because someone else has a different opinion doesn't mean they're wrong. So reducing our attachment to opinions is a good start. Yeah? It's a good start for unraveling this very deep attachment to who we think we are. Similarly with that is giving up trying to control everything. Now, of course, if we're in positions of responsibility, management, then we have to take an active role in doing things, you know, trying to achieve certain outcomes. But like with the tree, the results are often out of our control. What we can do is pay attention to the causes and put a lot of effort into getting the causes right, but then you just have to let go. It's impossible to try to control every result. If we do, we drive ourselves crazy and we drive everyone else crazy. And we'll never see things as they truly are because we're trying to manipulate them. And that ego manipulation is going to get in the way. So developing contentment. Often we think of contentment as something that is at the end of the path. Once we have attained clear insight and realization, we'll be very content. But contentment is also a meditation practice that we can practice in the beginning. How much do we need to be happy? Or if we're feeling discontent in some way, what are the roots of that? Right? How much do I need right now? Are we happy with what we have? This job, this partner, this lifestyle, this the state of our health, the weather, the government, the amount of money we have. You know, these are all things that we can either be content with or discontent with. So how much do we need to be happy? So this starts to get the mind going in the direction of insight. Right? It's not insight yet, but you know, these types of ways of looking at life starts to fertilize the ground and prepare the ground for insight to happen. And number 11. In Buddhism, we have this concept of true friends. A good friend or a true friend. In Pali, it's called a Kalyanamitta. Now, these are people who have our true welfare at heart. People who really care about us. Ideally, a Kalyanamitta is an enlightened master who can then guide us compassionately along the path, you know, towards Nibbana. But even if we don't have that, then any teacher who can offer some words of advice, some helpful guidance, or an example. And even if we don't have that, then if we have other people around us who can help support our aspiration. So this is very important. The Buddha wasn't just teaching a meditation technique. He was teaching, you know, this is a lifestyle, and he recognized that if we feel alone, it's very difficult. And if you have a supportive network of people around you, you know, people who share your aspiration, or at least support you in your aspiration, even if they don't share it, then that is going to be so much more effective. So Kalyanamitta is very, very important. True friends. Yeah. Now, it's inescapable that the people we hang out with will influence us. It's just the way conditioning works. And the Buddha recommended to, if you can, spend time with people who have the qualities that you aspire towards. Right? Now, sometimes we don't have a choice. And when we don't have a choice and we have to be with people that we find frustrating or we don't like or they don't like us or they have very different values than we do, then we make the best of it. And we can learn something from that as well. But when we have a choice, then if we aspire to be a kind person, then try to spend time with kind people. If you aspire to be generous or peaceful or serene, then have friends who are generous, peaceful, and serene. If you want to be wise, then try to find someone who's wise. Spend time with them. Similarly, our environment. We can't get away from the fact that our environment conditions us. Where we live, the people, but the situation that we're living in will condition us. Once you're all fully enlightened, and I hope that's soon, then the environment doesn't play a role. It doesn't shake the purity of mind. But prior to that, the environment does affect us. Even when the Buddha was enlightened, he still lived in the forest. You know, it wasn't like, oh, now I'm enlightened, I'll move to the city. More exciting. But the environment affects us. At our monastery in New Zealand, It's 150 acres, and we have different areas of different environments. Some are more open, and some are just thick native forest. And the native forest in that part of New Zealand is almost like a jungle, just full of ferns and vines, and it's very thick. And as soon as you walk into even a small patch of that forest, you can just feel your mind go, it's just so calming. It's just the power of the environment. And, you know, sometimes we need all the help we can get. You know, if you live in a situation which is noisy, chaotic, created out of human ego, you know, and is constantly pulling us to increase our defilements, stimulating greed, desire, anger, then it's very difficult to practice the Dhamma within that. It's not impossible. Like with people, sometimes we don't have a choice. If we don't have a choice, then you know, we make the best of whatever environment we live in. But even within a city, we can create an environment which is a little island of peace, little islands of sanity. And that's very important. You know, it's one thing. You know, it's one of many causes of conditions that will assist us in developing insight. If you live in an environment which is going to be supportive of a chaotic mind that's a mess, you know, the insights won't go very deep. Now, through all of this, it's important to have faith in oneself. Sense of confidence in the teachings, a confidence and faith in the enlightenment of the Buddha. These are traditional forms of faith which are important. But also it's important to have faith or confidence in one's ability to actually attain insights. Sometimes, certainly Nibbana seems so far away. Even insights can seem far away, kind of somewhat mysterious. And it's easy to fall into the trap of, well, you know, my mind, when I sit down to meditate, it's hopeless. My mind's all over the place. I'll never really have insights. You know, it's easy to be self-disparaging. So it's important to just remind ourselves that, look, all of the great masters, they all started just like us. They all started, even the Buddha, you know, started out with a mind that was influenced by greed, hatred, and delusion. And then through their own effort, you know, they then gradually attained what they did. And everyone, every person, has the same potential. Now, it is true that we all come into this life with different natural abilities. And some have very deep natural, spiritual, or meditative inclinations. Some of the teachers that I met in Thailand, for example, one that was just at our monastery recently is a disciple of Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Piak. Ajahn Piak, for most of his life in Thailand, he was Thai. He was kind of a middle class student, you know, following higher education, and then through series of circumstances, he decided to try meditation, especially with the forest tradition. And within like the first couple of times that he'd ever meditated, his mind went very, very peaceful into deep states of samadhi. And this doesn't happen to everybody, right? I mean, it's a sign that some people have different degrees of natural ability. But the human potential is equal among everybody. We all have the potential, and we all we all definitely have the potential to benefit from Dhamma practice, and it's important to remind ourselves that. As our practice becomes a bit more refined, then mindful awareness, or developing an attentiveness, needs to become more refined as well. And there's a practice which then pays attention to every time we have sense contact. Paying close attention to seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and cognizing. So when we see something, there's a lot going on. Even just in the act of seeing, it reinforces the sense of I am seeing. It creates a sense of separation. Now seeing is merely seeing, hearing is merely hearing, but very quickly there's a positive, negative reaction to that that goes together with projecting perceptions, and very quickly that leads into the complications of I like this, I don't like that. I want more of this, I want to hold on to this, I want to get rid of that. And it gets more complicated from there. But when mindfulness becomes very attuned, then we try to get closer and closer to reality as it actually is, before we start adding layers of interpretation. Seeing, for example, there is shape, there's color. Right? Even that may be projected. Right? But this is, at least we can say with the shape and the color, and then we can see how concepts are added to that. Or let's say if you have physical discomfort. If you have physical discomfort and immediately identify it as pain, that usually has a negative connotation, and we want to get rid of it. Even just mentioning the word pain can bring up a sense of tightness or stress in the body. So if there's physical sensation, then what exactly is going on there? Take that as your meditation object. So when you're sitting meditation, for example, after a period of time, you start to get sensations in your ankles or your knee or your back. Instead of trying to get away from that, then say, okay, instead of paying attention to the breath, I'm going to pay attention to these physical sensations. And just note, this thing that I call pain or discomfort, where exactly is it located? Is it one place? Is it moving around? Am I able to pay attention to this without labeling it as pain, as discomfort, as my knee? These are all concepts that we add on to the bare reality of sense contact. So the more we're able to merely see sensations as sensations, and then every time we add something to that, we see that as well. And then we start to get a handle on how quickly we create our reality. Something as simple as a sensation in the knee can, in a second, go into, I don't like that, that's pain, I don't want to do that, I'm always experiencing pain, why me? And it can reinforce maybe a lifetime of conditioning. So in order to halt or slow down that deluded process, then we try to stay as close to seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, cognizing as possible. And then, you know, life becomes more peaceful. Seeing is merely seeing. It doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be the perfect sight. You know? Even if it's something we don't like. You know? We see something, and it's so easy to become upset. So, well, seeing is just seeing. It's just a sight. And we see something, oh, we go excited, it's passionate. It's just a sight. So one time Sariputta, one of the Buddha's leading disciples, was on alms round, and someone was berating him in public. And he was just calmly walking on, and the junior monk behind him said, "That was so unfair. How did you, you know, I can't believe, why didn't you stop and correct him? Those were false accusations. That was ridiculous." Sariputta just said, "It was just sound. It's just sound. Criticism, it's just sound. Praise, it's just sound." Or maybe it's not just sound. Praise is praise is real. But if you don't want to be attached to criticism, then you have to not be attached to praise as well. Or taste, you know, we can get so involved with taste. Meet some people, they're like, "Oh, this tea is from the upper mountains of this province in Taiwan, and it's just like so refined. You can taste that little bit of difference, and oh, it was, you know, it was harvested in the early spring. You know, it's different than the summer." And I'm like, you know, taste is just a taste. Taste is just a taste, you know, but we can make so much up of it. And that's how we create this reality, which is it's just based on deluded projections. So this sense awareness, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and cognizing, when we get used to doing this with the rest of our five senses, then we're able to catch what's happening in the mind very quickly. You know, a thought arises. Well, thought's just a thought. It doesn't mean it's right. It doesn't mean it's wrong. It doesn't mean it's a problem. It doesn't even mean it's our thought. It could just be regurgitated from something we read, something else, someone else said. So very quickly, we start to catch where we add identification. My thought, my pain, you know, my tea, my taste, my, you know, it's like, and we start to realize, I'm doing this all the time. No wonder these habits, deluded habits, are so deep and difficult to overcome, because we're doing it all the time. So this helps to gather our energy, because when our mental energy, our awareness, is always going out to getting excited or upset at something that we see, or excited about something that we hear, excited about something that we think, or just distracted, it's exhausting. It's like all of our energy is just leaking out through these six senses. But as we gradually say, okay, well, that's seeing, that's hearing, that's valid, that's thought, all right? It's like it builds up an internal energy. And it becomes more and more peaceful. The mind becomes more content not to move. The reason why we get so distracted by seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching is because we think we need that for happiness, or sometimes or maybe out of fear, we need to get rid of something or change something. But actually then we start to realize, just being still and centered is rather peaceful, rather pleasant. And then once that starts to gain a bit of momentum, then it becomes easier and easier and easier to go there. And then this is developed more systematically in meditation. And then we start to actually experience some inner peace, where you can sit down either with your eyes closed and just be with your breath, and you're totally content. breathing in, breathing out. Or maybe you're just sitting on a park bench. Mind is still, centered, serene. Now this is what we call samadhi. Samadhi is that development of the mind which is calm, peaceful, stable, centered. Generally, insights will go as deep as one's samadhi. If we have a mind which is very scattered, even if we're trying to sincerely investigate and contemplate, it doesn't really have the power or the ability to go beyond the surface. We're just kind of scratching at the surface. Like aware of this and we're aware of that, and I see this is impermanent and that's changing and that's changing, but somehow it doesn't really sink in. But when generally the mind is still, it develops power and energy when that happens. It's like Ajahn Chah used to say, if you want to make the body strong, you move it around. But if you want to make the mind strong, you allow it to be still. And it gathers power and energy, and then insights will start to arise naturally from that. That is the beginning. As long as these five hindrances are present, then the samadhi will be very weak. Mind's constantly distracted. But if you're sitting in meditation, you kind of check, is there any sensual desire there? No, I'm not fantasizing about ice cream or anything. It's like, okay, I'm not, not angry at what that person said right now. I'm kind of awake, alert and awake. And no remorse over my previous actions at the moment. I'm quite clear on what needs to be done. There's clear awareness, it's bright, it's pleasant, right? This is what samadhi is. In the commentaries, in the Buddhist commentaries, they call this level of samadhi access concentration. And this is the level where the five hindrances are not present in the mind, at least temporarily, and yet we're still seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and able to think. And this is the area, this is the state of mind where insight can arise. In deeper states of samadhi, which are also extremely beneficial, you can't have insights. In jhana, for example, the mind is unified. It's a one. So part of the mind can't be contemplating or investigating another part of reality. It's just one. It's just unification. Now, when it comes out of jhana, it's got tremendous strength and clarity, and you come into the state of extended purity of mind. But then, if after a lifetime of somewhat chaotic mind states, you're finally feeling like totally centered and peaceful and joyful and happy, you think, I'm there, this is good enough. But we're only halfway there. So then, then it may be necessary to kind of motivate oneself. Say, no, this is the opportunity for sustained contemplation, right? Stimulate the mind, stimulate contemplation. If the mind is clear, a certain amount of insights are going to start popping up naturally. If you're just feeling peaceful and centered, we start to see things that we didn't see before. Because our minds were scattered, we never saw them before, we just overlooked them. We're in our own thoughts. If we're constantly in our own thoughts, we literally do not see things that are right in front of our eyes. So when we become very aware and clear and centered, you know, heightened mindfulness, and we start to notice, oh, you know, there's other people out there. With, they have their lives too. It's not just all about me. You know, we notice colors. We notice a whole lot more. But in order for insights to go very deep, it can be necessary to kind of aim that clarity in a particular direction. And so we have a series of contemplative meditations that we do. For example, we tend to be predisposed to noticing things arising, something new, a new sight, a new sound, a new taste, a new feeling in the body, a new thought. But we tend to ignore the cessation. Now, for something to arise, something had to cease previously. And if we only look at the beginning of things when it's exciting, it's like any cycle. In the beginning, it's new, it's exciting. That's what we want to pay attention to. It's gratifying. And then it maybe that wears off a bit and then it ceases. It happens on a momentary basis, happens on a larger scale basis as well. But consciously turning our attention to the cessation helps us to see things in balance where we normally otherwise wouldn't. And when the mind is in this state of clarity, not distracted, then we can have a chance. We have a chance then to have a sustained contemplation without being pulled away by distracting thoughts. And to just notice how things cease. A thought ceases. It's not like we're continually thinking. There are gaps. Thoughts arise, but then they end. And notice the ending. And when something ceases, it's peaceful. And we can listen to a sound. Our attention generally is drawn to the form. But when the sound ends, then what? Then there's silence. We pay attention to the silence, pay attention to the space, pay attention to what happens when things cease, where do they go, and what's left. And we start to realize that the sounds, the sights, the smells, the tastes, the touches, all of these things that comprise our reality are actually just arising and passing away within a greater awareness of spaciousness, spacious silence. What we pay attention to tends to grow. That tends to become our reality. If we only pay attention to the beginning of things, that becomes our reality, and we don't have enough information to make wise choices. Mindfulness is like this light which shines on everything if we give it a chance. If our mindfulness only pays attention to a very narrow sliver of reality, then all of our choices are based on that one very narrow sliver of reality, right? And we can't really fault ourselves for that, right? We make choices based on the information we have, consciously or unconsciously. Now, mindfulness, especially this type of contemplation where we try to bring our awareness into areas that we don't normally look at. So then we start to see a much, much wider spectrum of reality. And when we look at it, we say, well, of course, it's real, it's there. How did I never see it before? So obvious, it's there. Paying attention to cessation is one of them. Meditation on the non-identification with the body. Identification with the body is so deeply ingrained that we often simply don't notice it. We don't pay attention to the fact that this thing that we identify with so strongly is actually just a composition of parts that are constantly changing. And if we look at the individual parts, it's obvious that that's not, you know, that's that individual part, that physical thing. That's not who I really am. You know, if you gradually take the body apart mentally and set it all out, say, well, which part is me? And it's only when it goes back together that at some point this concept of me and identification starts to creep in. So this is something that we don't normally look at, but is obviously very real. And if our goal is to understand what it means to be human, then, well, we have this body, we have this mind. Let's really investigate the body. Let's take a close look at it and the impermanence of the body. And then we get into contemplation of death. Another area which maybe many people don't want to look at, right? Death, it can be uncomfortable. But is it real? Yes, it's real. Well, why would we not want to be aware of it? The Buddha so emphasized contemplation of death that he said, even if you take one mouthful of food and you're chewing it, you should be reflecting that I could die by the end of this mouthful. Or when we're breathing in, we reflect, I could die before I breathe out. So that we're living with this reality of the cessation of our bodies. Right? So we have to take this trained mind and then aim it into areas of life that we don't normally look at. And this starts to challenge our assumptions. It challenges everything. I remember the first time that I did this systematic body contemplation, and it just felt like my world was turned upside down. It's like these assumptions that I had just assumed to be absolutely true without questioning them suddenly were questioned. And so this this requires courage, because you're going into areas which are challenging. Yeah. You have to be willing. You have to be willing to go into areas which no longer feel safe for real insight to occur. And this is what insights are about. Insights will not merely reinforce what we think we already know. Insight is about challenging the status quo. It challenges our delusion. And our long-standing habits will sometimes begin to fight back. They feel like they're fighting back. And so it takes this persistent effort. You just have to keep going at it. I was telling one meditation master that I had met. He was this old Thai meditation master who had lived in the forest for most of his years as a monk. Talking to him about samadhi and the insights that come from investigation of the body and death. And he said, yeah, that's right. And you may have to do that another 1,000 times for the insights to really sink in. Because our defilements, our habits, our perceptual ways of looking at things in a deluded way is so, so deep. You just can't believe how deep it is. And we have an insight and it seems so clear. And we think, now we've got it, I see. And then the next day or a couple days later, next week, it seems all faded away. Then you start to realize this is not a quick fix. You know, you really got to be in it for the long haul, and it requires a real persistence of effort, you know, a dedication of just being able to stick with it again and go again and again and again, and whether it's peaceful or whether it's pleasant or whether we feel inspired or it's not, you know. Then we just keep doing it, keep practicing, keep developing meditation, keep using what wisdom we have to probe and look, well, what, you know, where am I attached? Where does this identification come from? What are the causes which lead to suffering? And what are the causes which lead to happiness? And then keep going there. You know? So then all day long, you know, if we get in this mode, then all day long, everything that happens can be fuel for insight, potentially. Everything we see, you know, we see something and there's, I am seeing, but, you know, where does that come from? Even that much is setting ourselves up for dukkha, subtle dukkha in the future. So then everything we do throughout the day can be this movement for developing insight, you know, encouraging the mind to see more clearly. You know, kind of use your intelligence, not to self-sabotage. As often, you know, we have these refined intellects and we often use them against ourselves, but actually use our intelligence in a way to try to clarify and pinpoint the causes of suffering. And then insight starts to flow. Yeah. So with all of this, that was number 19, by the way. So the 20th essential cause is this a dedication to mastery, where, you know, if we take on this practice as a hobby, then we'll achieve results that are in accordance with what we might expect if we just take something on as a hobby. If we just sit down to meditate every time, just see what happens, then the results are going to be a bit hodgepodge. You know, sometimes it feels peaceful, sometimes not, sometimes we kind of stumble into something. But it's important, it's very helpful to be systematic in our practice. Right? At some point you just take this seriously and say, no, I'm going to be really systematic about how I do this. And when I sit down, then I'm going to have a clear intention of the purpose of this practice, clear intention of where we're headed. You know, you have an idea, at least you have a clear conceptual idea of where this is headed, where we want to go. You know, even if that wanting is initially diluted, at least it's kind of motivating us to go in the right direction. And then just be willing to do it. And everything else that we do in life, then is less of a priority. Right? I mean, what is insight? I mean, it's training for life. It is that which is going to make everything else better. So, you know, by definition, it is the most important thing we can do with our life. So then, our relationships, our jobs, our work, our everything else we do, is important as well, but it kind of seen in this context of wow, how can I use this job? How can I make use of the situation? How can I understand things better so that it's not just exhausting and reinforcing my preconceived notions, but is actually fuel for understanding life better? So then we try to refine it, you know, with a real dedication, a persistent dedication in the face of adversity. You know, sometimes it's easy to meditate, Sometimes we're very lucky. We have all perfect conditions going on retreat, but not always. So in the face of adversity, you just have to stick with it as well. And finally, it's number 21, I guess. You have to be very patient. Just have to be very patient with yourself. Okay, so I'll offer this for your reflection this evening. Now, it's about 9 o'clock. If anyone needs to go at this point, you're very welcome. Well, thank you for coming. If anyone has any further questions, I'm happy to answer questions. Yes.
I enjoy my work as a music teacher, and I find that metaphors are useful and fun for conveying a discovery for the student. Could you share with us a metaphor for this inner process?
A metaphor for this inner process that relates to music? Oh, all right. I tend to think in terms of trees, because in our monastery in New Zealand, we planted over 10,000 trees. And so this becomes not just a reality, but then it becomes a metaphor for the whole path. You know, kind of, you're starting with seeds, you know, and it gradually grows, and in the beginning of this process of the unfolding of the mind, the growing of insight, then it needs to be protected, especially in the beginning. It's very fragile. And you can't just treat it roughly. You can't just throw it in the ground. You know, things need to be done just right for it to succeed. You know, there are causes and conditions for a tree to be able to grow properly. If you plant it in just the right way, you know, then the first planting day we had, invited all these people to plant. Everyone's enthusiastic to plant trees. Great. It was a total disaster. Found some of the trees have been planted in their plastic bags. People just don't know. But I find trees are a good metaphor for the entire spiritual path, because they tend to exhibit a lot of the same things that we do. You know, the trees that survive well are those that are flexible enough and they bend in the wind, you know. For example. Yes.
So in trying to kind of place a mindful awareness and say seeing and noticing colors and light and dark and forms, there's still some concept there. So do you recommend just noticing seeing or holding it all together, the concepts and how would you meditate with that?
Yeah. Concepts are not a problem. Concepts will be there. And of course, we need to make use of the concepts. But recognize the seeing part of seeing, and then recognize when the concepts come in. And recognize that concepts are projected from within our own minds. Right? So that is an important distinction, because often we see something and the concepts and perceptions arise so quickly we don't question it. And that just reinforces our particular deluded way of seeing things. And we tend to just interpret things in the way that we think they're going to exist already. So if we can catch it early, you know, as objectively as possible, that's hard. It takes a real You have to really pay attention. Try to pay attention to the exact time and moment where sense data arises before we start to feel pleasant or unpleasant, before we start to add whole layers of interpretation. And once we do, then you pay attention to that as well, but just kind of recognize how the process works. You know, there's sense contact, there's maybe a movement of the mind, maybe experience is pleasant or unpleasant to some degree, and then that, then if it's pleasant, then we tend to want more of it. If it's unpleasant, we want to try to get rid of it. Very quickly, identification comes in. I want this. I don't like that. You know, that reinforces the sense of the deluded sense of me, I, as a separate individual. Right? And that can all happen in a split second. So mindfulness has to be very quick. Often big decisions in life are a result of innumerable small decisions. At least that was my experience in life. There was never one point where I said, okay, now I'm going to be a monk. Or at least if that was a result of innumerable small decisions leading up to that point, where you just kind of go, in this situation, what feels right, what feels beneficial, what seems to be, what you have to trust your heart, you know, to a certain degree. If you try to make lists of pros and cons, it's not as accurate as just going, well, what feels right, and then say, well, this feels right, I can't explain why, but it just feels right, and trust that, and that's one little decision, and that kind of then gets us into a situation where maybe, okay, well, now we have different options, and then we kind of move in another direction. Before you know it, you're a monk. Or a nun. Right? Any lifestyle potentially is conducive to practice. There's nothing magical about the robes, but if you live a lifestyle which allows you more time to practice, is more encouraging to practice the Dhamma. I mean, in the monastery, everything we do is bringing us back to the Dhamma. All of our influence is bringing us back to the Dhamma. Even if we, you know, don't want to practice, we're keeping reminded, you know, not from teachers, but just the whole lifestyle, the monastic discipline that we follow, the chanting, the teachings, the books, you know, everything there. The people who come to the monastery, you know, they come because they're interested in the Dhamma, and then we talk about Dhamma, and, you know, so everything is reinforcing it. In a positive way, it's very supportive, it's very nurturing, it's very encouraging. So in that way, monastic life is very helpful. But we also have lay people staying in our monastery regularly, and they can stay for long periods of time, and they have they live essentially the same lifestyle. They have the same environment, the same supportive conditions. They don't have robes or necessarily a shaved head, but they are able to live essentially the same lifestyle. So that's more the key thing, right? I mean, if you're You know, if you ordain, but then you don't really practice, nothing special about it, right? It's only meant to be a vehicle to allow us to practice the Dhamma more conveniently. Now, if you're independently wealthy and you can set up a little retreat somewhere and you can just meditate all the time and you have, you know, teachers and Kalyanamita, and then, you know, you could have a pretty solid practice as a layperson. I mean, even if you're not independently wealthy. But, if things are arranged in a particular way, if that's really the priority in life, then, yeah, you can get a pretty solid practice going, right? I mean, I've known some people in Thailand, for example, they work their job and they come home and they sit meditation for 4 hours. you have to be willing to sacrifice some things for that to happen. It's something has to be sacrificed. For something to be gained, you have to let go of certain things. And so we can't do everything. Our time and our energy is limited. So if Dhamma practice is really important, then we just need to devote more time and energy to that. And it's so easy to kind of say, oh, I'll do it tomorrow, or cut it short today, or, oh, well, everything is Dhamma, so I don't really need to sit meditation. I'll just brush my teeth. it's just a lot easier to be pulled away from Dhamma practice when you're surrounded by family or workplace or billboards or television sets, it just makes it more difficult. You know? Rather than things always pulling you back to the Dhamma, it's like everything's trying to pull you away from it.